here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us?
Today is Friday, April 27th. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Claire Eagle. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia, to our campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It is 5 o'clock and time for another full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover news from the UBC campus, local news from Metro Vancouver, provincial and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world.
All this, plus your weekend weather forecast, right here on News 101, your source for independent news. And now, for your UBC campus and local headlines.
On April 26th, UBC held a public hearing confirming Gage South's academic designation and finalizing the location of the new aquatic center and bus loop by amending the UBC land use plan. A new amendment to the land use plan also enables campus and community planning to transfer market housing density originally proposed for the UBC farm to Acadia East and Stadium Road. University Neighborhoods Association resident Claire Robson voiced opposition to the density transfers, which would allow campus and community planning to build the maximum amount of market housing density possible in Acadia East and Stadium Road, or else transfer it elsewhere on campus at a later date. UBC Insider's editor Neil Johnson, who submitted a petition with over 20,000 signatures to keep Gage South zoned as academic, as well as oppose density transfers, also spoke at the public hearing. While Johnson congratulated campus and community planning for making the right choice on the designation of Gage South, he questioned the density transfers. The hearing finished in less than an hour with only two speakers and one question on the location of the bus loop. 16 people were in attendance. Those who were unable to attend were able to submit emails or letters to be included in the public hearing. Campus and community planning received 16 submissions. 14 were in regards to the bus loop. Campus and community planning have defended the amendment, saying the density transfers were always a part of the process, and conversion of any academic land for market housing would have to go through another amendment process. The land use plan amendments will be finalized at the June 12 Board of Governors meeting.
The Faculty of Dentistry at the University of British Columbia has opened a clinical research center focusing on best practices and evidence-based patient care thanks to a $1 million donation from Frontier Dental Laboratories. Named the Frontier Clinical Research Center, the new initiative allows researchers and industry participants to evaluate and generate scientific data for existing procedures and materials. Dr. Charles Schuler, Faculty of Dentistry Dean, said, quote, "This gift will ensure that BC continues to maintain the highest standards of dentistry. The Frontier Clinical Research Center will be an important resource for oral health providers, industry professionals, and patients," end quote. The Frontier Clinical Research Center will provide contracted services including statistical consultation, budget planning, recruitment of subjects, data collection and analysis, and much more.
Mayors from 8 BC communities have added their voices to calls to the provincial government to regulate and tax marijuana as part of a strategy to end gang violence and make communities safer. Mayors from Vancouver, Burnaby, not Vancouver City, Vernon, Armstrong, Enderby, Lake Country, and Metchosin, made the argument in an April 26 letter to BC's Premier, opposition NDP leader, and BC Conservative Party leader. The letter appeared on the website of Stop the Violence BC, a coalition of law enforcement officials, legal experts, academics, and public health officials. This group wants to develop and implement marijuana policies that reduce social harms. In their letter, the mayors argue prohibition has led to large-scale grow-ups, increased organized crime, ongoing gang violence, and larger police budgets. Based on statistics from the Organized Crime Agency of BC, the mayors state 85% of the province's marijuana industry is controlled by criminal groups. Using statistics from the Right of Center policy group, the Fraser Institute, the mayors also state the industry is worth $7 billion annually. While the provincial NDP supports decriminalization, said the party's justice critic, Leonard Krog, said that the New Democrats understand the federal government has jurisdiction on the issue. Krog said that there is a growing consensus among British Columbians that marijuana should be decriminalized and it's time to debate the issue, end quote. Vancouver councillor Kerry Yang, who is also a professor of psychiatry at UBC, said the current federal laws have failed. He said the laws have led to increased organized crime, policing costs, and the presence of co-ops. Jiang said, quote, whatever the federal government policy is, it's not working, and we are saying that we need a better approach, and that is to regulate it using a public health model, much as we do, for example, with tobacco or alcohol, end quote.
Vancouver's annual fireworks competition, often in danger of sputtering out because of a lack of money, will be able to step on the gas this year after signing a sponsorship deal with Honda Canada. In fact, Honda has agreed to serve as sponsor for the next 3 years, keeping the event afloat through the summer of 2014. This year, three new countries will participate in the competition, Brazil, Italy, and Vietnam, and fireworks chair John Reynolds says some extra reserve seating may be added. He said some tickets have already been sold, even though there's been no advertising for the fireworks yet. The three-day event will be held on July 28th, August 1st, and August 4th. Last year's show was given the Best Public Entertainment Award at the 2012 Canadian Event Industry Awards handed out in Toronto on March 30th.
Four people are facing charges in Vancouver over lottery scams, in which elderly victims in the U.S. were told they'd won huge jackpots but had to send thousands of dollars in fees and taxes in order to claim the prizes. Police were alerted to one case by police in Hillsborough, California, who reported an 89-year-old woman was telephoned and told she won $7.5 million in an Australian lottery and was persuaded to wire $70,000 to a Vancouver account to collect the winnings. The investigation led police to an accounting and tax consulting firm in Vancouver and has now resulted in fraud and forgery charges against two men and a woman, 38-year-old Farid Raza, 30-year-old Shaheem Raza, and 27-year-old Nazifa Raza. Police say in a similar scam, a 76-year-old man in Pittsburgh sent more than $14,000 to an address in Richmond, BC, in order to collect a fake prize from Publishers Clearing House. An investigation into that case has resulted in fraud charges against 30-year-old Richard Williams of Surrey. Vancouver police are warning about a spike in the number of such scams, saying in some cases seniors have been duped out of their entire life savings.
The Vancouver Aquarium announced Friday afternoon the receipt of the largest donation in its 55-year history. The gift of $12.5 million came from Tech Resources. John Nightingale, president and CEO of the Vancouver Aquarium, announced that the money will go towards a $100 million expansion and revitalization plan, quote, to ensure a robust future for the next 55 years, end quote. Mr. Nightingale unveiled plans for a new and expanded central entrance and visitor hub to be known as a Tech Connections Gallery. It is expected to begin construction soon and open in May 2014. In addition to funding construction, Tech's contribution will go towards educational programs and research focused on water conservation issues, said Don Lindsay, President and CEO of Tech.
And those are your UBC campus and local headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick break, but stay tuned for your local weather forecast as well as your provincial and national headlines.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM.
As interesting as listening to this PSA is, there's nothing quite like watching it. Watching what, you ask? The annual showcase of films that accompany it as part of the POV, or Persistence of Vision Film Festival. This showcase of short films written, directed, shot, edited, and produced by students in the film production program at UBC happens only once a year. On April 27th and 28th, join the POV Festival at the Empire Granville 7 Cinemas in the heart of downtown Vancouver as these magnificent films are debuted. For tickets and information, visit POVFilmFestival.com.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
And welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver.
And it's now time for your weekend weather forecast. Unfortunately, not brought to you by the UBC Storm Club today, as they are busy with other things, as we all are at certain times. But we do have it brought to you by Environment Canada, which is almost as good as the UBC Storm Club. So, CJ, take it away.
Thank you, Claire. Well, tonight it is still cloudy, as you can tell, with 40% chance of showers and a low of 8 degrees. Saturday is also going to be relatively cloudy, with 40% chance of showers as well, with a high of 12 degrees. I do not know what UV index means, but it says 4.
That sounds pretty moderate to me.
Yes. Although the symbol does show a sun, so I'm going to assume there's going to be patches of sunshine here and there. Saturday night is also going to be mainly cloudy, with also a 40% chance of showers in the evening. The temperature steady near 9 degrees. And of course, to end the weekend weather forecast, you've got Sunday with a mix of sun and cloud, but hopefully it'll be sunny throughout the entire day with a high of 14 degrees and a low of 9 degrees. And that is your weekend weather forecast here on News 101. It is now time for your provincial and national headlines.
A Canadian-based team of scientists have produced the first peer-reviewed study on the threat Enbridge's Northern Gateway pipeline poses to BC parks and protected areas, finding 34 spots under threat of spills downstream of the pipeline. Dr. Paul Paquette, the senior scientist with the Rain Coast Conservation Foundation who oversaw the academic work in the paper, said researchers undertook the study because of perceived problems with Enbridge's pipeline proposal. To figure out the so-called true risk, the research team plotted park coordinates against the proposed pipeline route and looked at the effects of pumping oil, bitumen, or even condensate through the parks. They found 34 protected areas under threat from spills downstream of the pipeline. Paquette said that spilled oil can flow far downhill into streams and rivers, damaging spawning beds and fish habitats. Depending on the time and magnitude of the spill, the consequences could be serious. Of the 34 areas under threat, 4 of them, Monkland Park, Willem Lake Park, Stewart River Park, and Fraser River Park, were rated at the highest risk of a spill, located 102 kilometers from the pipeline compared to the average 303 kilometers. The Fraser River, BC's largest watershed and salmon run, contains the most downstream parks at risk in the province, 11 in total. Earlier this month, the federal government introduced a motion to speed up environmental reviews, including the current Enbridge assessment. The move angered environmental groups and opposition politicians, who said the motion would set environmental legislation back decades and deny some of the roughly 4,000 registered speakers a chance to voice their views at the Enbridge hearings.
A landmark lawsuit. Apologies. The union representing 4,600 Insurance Corporation of BC, ICBC workers, say they have voted 87% in favor of a strike. The vote gives the employees' union, Scope 378, the go-ahead to initiate job action in the next 3 months if it sees fit. The move marks the latest escalated between the provincial auto insurance provider and its unionized workers, who have been without a collective bargaining agreement since June of 2010. COPE 378 Vice President Jeff Gillies said, quote, ICBC has dug their heels in and they want a 5-year collective agreement with no increases to wages or benefits, end quote. Adding that the Crown Corporation has so far refused to provide guarantees on job security and workload, which is a primary concern for union members. In response to the vote, a spokesperson for ICBC said the company had several negotiations with the union and hopes for a settlement. But he also said that the corporation has an obligation to ensure services for its customers and has thus submitted an application to the BC Labour Relations Board to have certain workers deemed as providing essential services. Under current provincial legislation, the BC Crown Corporations can appeal to have some job action named illegal if striking poses a, quote, immediate and serious danger to the health, safety, or welfare of the residents of British Columbia, end quote. ICBC and their union, COPE 378, will head back to the bargaining table on May 9th and 10th.
A landmark lawsuit against an energy giant and two Alberta government regulatory agencies concerning water well contamination by hydraulic fracturing started with an unusual twist in Alberta's Court of Queen's Bench yesterday. Judge B.L. Vedus began the proceedings in a drumheller courtroom attended by 20 landowners from across the province by admitting that she was going to do something unexpected. She then asked for a shorter statement of claim. Jessica Ernst, a 54-year-old oil patch consultant and scientist from Rosebud, Alberta, is suing Encana, one of the continent's largest unconventional gas producers, for negligence causing water contamination, and the Alberta Energy Resources Conservation Board, the ERCB, the province's energy regulator, for breaching the Charter of Rights. The lawsuit alleges that the regular, quote-unquote, banished Ernst, now a celebrated landowner of the province, from contact with the board after she publicly spoke out about the water well contamination and noise pollution. In addition, the $33 million lawsuit alleges that Alberta Environment, one of two agencies responsible for groundwater protection, failed to uphold its regulatory responsibilities. The lawsuit effectively puts on trial the practice and the regulation of hydraulic fracturing, the controversial blasting of coal, oil, and shale formations with toxic chemicals, sand, and water.
The RCMP must cooperate with the Charbonneau Commission into Corruption, the Quebec Superior Court has ruled. Judge Guylaine Bourge ordered the force to appear before the commission with documents requested in subpoenas sent to it in January and March. The Charbonneau Commission wants to see a wealth of evidence obtained by the RCMP in Project Colisée, a years-long investigation into organized crime in the province that led to high-profile arrests. The federal government argued during hearings in court that the subpoenas were too broad and that the information obtained through wiretaps and hidden cameras was for the force's eyes only. The commission has been trying to get the evidence since late last year, claiming it contains proof of direct links between the mafia and construction firms throughout the province. Citing the Supreme Court of Canada, Bourge said commissions are often set up to discover the truth in reaction to shock, horror, disillusionment, or skepticism felt by the population, and serve an important function in Canadian society.
We're now going to take a quick break. But thank you for listening to provincial and national headlines on News 101. Stay tuned.
Sprat Records, CITR 101.9 FM and Discorder Magazine present the Sims Cake Release Party with guests Winter Mitz and Be Off. Friday, May 11th, at the Interurban Gallery, there will be an actual Sims cake to eat. It isn't just for robots. Advance tickets from Red Cat, Scratch, or Zulu. Time to get down and boogie with Sims Cake, May 11th, at the Interurban Gallery.
Do you know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's non-profit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union Building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen and then get riding.
Welcome back to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Claire Eagle. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver or online at citr.ca. Thank you very much for being with us on this lovely evening.
And it's now time for international headlines. We first go to Democracy Now!, where Amy Goodman and Nermeen Sheikh discuss student debt in America, as it has currently hit $1 trillion American dollars. Democracy Now! Interviewed Pamela Brown, a founding member of the Occupy Student Debt Campaign, and Dr. David Harvey, a professor of anthropology at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York.
Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Today marks what activists are calling 1T Day, the day U.S. student debt reaches $1 trillion. A coalition of groups from Occupy Wall Street plan to gather on college campuses and communities around the country to protest record-high college costs and call for an extension of low-interest rates on federally subsidized Stafford loans. The rates were reduced to 3.4% in 2007, but will double on July 1st for new loans unless Congress intervenes. According to the coalition, 2010 graduates had on average over $25,000 in student debts. As Republican presidential hopeful Mitt Romney moves closer to becoming the official Republican nominee who will challenge Democratic President Barack Obama in November's general election, both candidates are concentrating on wooing the youth vote, pointing especially to the issue of student debt. Speaking to students at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, Obama said every American family should be able to afford higher education.
We can't price the middle class out of a college education, not at a time when most new jobs in America will require more than a high school diploma. Whether it's at a four-year college or a two-year program, we can't make higher education a luxury. It's an economic imperative. Every American family should be able to afford it.
President Obama will also speak at the University of Colorado in Boulder and the University of Iowa in Iowa City. Romney's victories in five primary states Tuesday earned him numerous delegates and allows him to focus on the general election campaign against Obama. He's backed Obama's proposal to extend low rates on government-subsidized student loans through next year. To talk more about the issue of student debt, we're joined by Pamela Brown. She's a sociology PhD student at the New School who helped launch the Occupy Student Debt campaign, Pledge of Refusal. Pam, welcome to Democracy Now! What's the Pledge of Refusal?
Hi, thanks for having me, Amy. Thank you. The Pledge of Refusal asks that a million people come together to unite and refuse student debt. And the reason that we need to do that is we need to end our complicity with Wall Street at this point in terms of the $1 trillion crisis that we're dealing with. It's really just become an issue that we need to take action on, take direct action. And this is a nonviolent direct action form of civil disobedience. It's a form of non-cooperation with Wall Street.
Can you explain that, though, Pamela Brown? Because I think most people are under the impression that these loans are with the government, the debts are with the government, but you say Wall Street is involved.
That's absolutely correct. And that's a big problem that we have in terms of having people understand the true situation. The government only recently began to take on the majority of direct lending. So that's only in recent years. The vast majority of the $1 trillion worth of student debt is actually held by Wall Street banks. And those banks actually securitize these loans, and they sell them off, and they make enormous profits from them. Furthermore, even the loans that are held by the government are ultimately securitized. Companies are paid, they're compensated for servicing these loans. Because so many people are actually unable to pay them, we have a crisis where we have about 5 million people who are actually in default, and then there are companies that make enormous profits off of collecting on these loans, and these are Wall Street companies.
Can you say a little about the action that's planned today? What exactly are you planning to
do? Today is a National Day of Action, and we're commemorating this horrible milestone, which is $1 trillion of student debt. There are actions planned throughout the country. Here in New York, we're going to meet in Union Square at 4 p.m. We're going to have Reverend Billy, who's going to give us a debt jubilee, where we're going to free ourselves of this enormous burden. Nationally, there are actions planned throughout the United States at various colleges, as well as at all of the Sallie Mae regional offices, as well as the D.C. Headquarters.
At the same address in North Carolina, President Obama explained the implications of doubling interest rates on student debt.
5 years ago, Congress cut the rate on federal student loans in half. That was a good thing to do. But on July 1st, that's a little over 2 months from now, that rate cut expires. And if Congress does nothing, the interest rates on those loans will double overnight. So I'm assuming a lot of people here have federal student loans. The interest rates will double unless Congress acts by July 1st. And just to give you some sense of perspective, for each year that Congress doesn't act, the average student with these loans will rack up an additional $1,000 in debt, an extra $1,000. That's basically a tax hike for more than 7 million students across America, more than 160,000 students here in North Carolina alone.
President Obama speaking at North Carolina yesterday, Pam Brown. Position of the Republicans and the Democrats.
Well, it's good to know that they are at this point that both Mitt Romney and President Obama are in favor of keeping this reduction of the interest rate. But we have to also understand that this particular rate that we're talking about only applies to newly originated federal loans that are taken out recently. It does nothing to solve the massive $1 trillion problem whatsoever.
And what about the various reform proposals that Congress is looking at now, from bankruptcy to debt forgiveness? Can you talk about those?
Sure. Well, to start with the bankruptcy proposal, I mean, these proposals have been over many years, there have been many different proposals. I think there's been at least 4 different bills in Congress just trying to restore bankruptcy protection, even in some cases just in the case of being in a horrible accident where you're no longer able to work. These are very small requests, and none of them have ever passed. So that's problematic. In terms of the forgiveness bill, it could be a great measure. Of course, anything that can alleviate the suffering of recent generations who really find this debt unpayable could be useful, but it's very unlikely that it's actually going to pass. class. And once again, it only deals with a small amount of the problem.
Let's bring in David Harvey, Distinguished Professor of Anthropology at the Graduate Center of City University of New York. You have a new book called Rebel Cities, From the Right to the City to the Urban Revolution. Your comment on this day, what is being called 1T Day, the day student debt has reached $1 trillion in the United States.
One thing is an immense contradiction. On the one hand, we're being told we should accept a great deal of austerity because we don't want to saddle future generations with this enormous federal debt. At the same time, as we're actually saddling a whole generation of students with immense personal debt. So go figure. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. The other thing I would say is I went through a tuition-free system. I was educated with no tuition, and my own university, CUNY, was tuition-free up until the 1970s, and then a huge campaign was waged by the Business Roundtable, the Rockefeller Brothers, and everything else to impose tuition on CUNY. And ever since then, there's been this immense attempt by corporations and the wealthy and so on to pass the costs of education onto the people who are being educated. This is something that the economists call externalities. That is, they don't want to pay for training their own labor force. They want the labor force to train itself, and then they'll use it. But the result of that is we have this enormous defect in American higher education. I mean, this is one of the least educated countries now out of all of the OECD countries. The achievement in math and science are way, way down compared to everywhere else. And, you know, this is a disaster from the standpoint of the national interest.
Let me ask, I was watching some right-wing pundits on television yesterday who were saying, this is interestingly enough, they were saying a bailout of these universities whose costs have gone out of control, that's what the government subsidies are all about. The loans are all about subsidizing these universities. They should just bring down their costs.
Well, it's true in the sense that the costs of higher education have been escalated in this. The way, way beyond the rate of inflation, tuition rates have been going up. But even in a City University of New York, which is, we're having to impose higher tuitions because austerity comes from Albany and says we have less money from the state. And so, you know, it's putting the costs of education onto the people who are being educated and their long-term costs, as you mentioned, $1 trillion now. And you kind of go, this is unacceptable. This is debt peonage for a large chunk of the population.
Pamela Brown, can you talk a little bit about how this debt is divided among the student population, the racial dimensions of a debt mm-hmm. distribution?
Right. Numbers are somewhat like, I believe it's 1 in 4 Caucasian students have under $13,000 worth of debt, whereas 1 in 3 African American students have over $38,000 worth of student debt. So student debt is really a critical juncture in the production of inequality that we're dealing with in society right now, and it's something that Occupy Wall Street has been raising awareness about.
We're going to interrupt the broadcast because right now we have just gotten a call from Mumia Abu-Jamal from prison in Pennsylvania. Mumia Abu-Jamal is speaking to us.
Well, thank you to Democracy Now! For that interview with Pamela Brown, a founding member of the Occupy Student Debt Campaign, and Dr. David Harvey, Professor of Anthropology at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. Amy Goodman and Nermeen Sheikh discussed student debt in America hitting $1 trillion. And now for our international headlines, we go to Free Speech Radio News.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. Today, the government of Romania collapsed after failing to stave off a no-confidence vote put forth by the opposition. The government has been unpopular because of its support of austerity measures pushed by the EU economic powers. The austerity has destabilized several European countries. In Romania, the fall of the government threatens to jeopardize loan monies from the IMF. FSRN's Donna Lepidot is on the line from Bucharest.
An IMF delegation is currently in Romania working through final loan negotiations. But just 1 hour after the government fell, the IMF delegation halted the talks. The Romanian currency fell to an all-time low against the euro. The no-confidence vote happened partly in response to unpopular austerity measures imposed by the ex-government. In February, protests in the capital prompted the resignation of Prime Minister Emil Bok. Today's ousted government was only in power for 3 months, and any new prime minister may not have much more time than that in office. Local elections are scheduled for June, and general election will happen in November. Dana Lepodat, Free Speech Radio News, Bucharest.
Thousands of Muslims in Sri Lanka today blocked roads, protesting against a notice by the government declaring land in the town of Dambulla as a Buddhist sacred site. Many residents are worried the declaration will mean a 50-year-old mosque will have to be relocated. Muslims, a minority in Sri Lanka, say a gang of monks and followers attacked the mosque last week, keeping people from Friday prayers. FSRN's Ponia Manikavasagam reports.
The crowd was angry, shouting slogans and carrying signs. Most of them were Muslims led by opposition politicians. Protesters urged the government to ease growing religious tension and curb conduct of extremist religious groups in the country. They also demanded the arrest of those who attacked the mosque last week, including the chief priest of the Dambulla Buddhist temple. Buddhists say the mosque is situated on a sacred site, and the government recently announced the removal of 71 buildings, including the mosque. Authorities had to summon the police to control the situation and clear the traffic jam caused by the protest. Ponniya Manikavasagam, FSRN, Sri Lanka.
Today, the U.S. House passed an extension on student loan rates. The Stafford loan interest rate was slated to double in July. But while Democrats are proposing to pay for the loan subsidies by closing what they call a loophole in the payroll tax, the Republican bill passed through the House pays for it by cutting funding for the Affordable Health Care Act. In other House news, late yesterday, representatives passed internet data sharing legislation known as CISPA. The bill expands the government's power to access user data from the internet in order to prevent cyber attacks. Civil rights advocates say it amounts to violations of privacy. The White House has vowed to veto the bill. The U.S. Senate has approved a renewal of the Violence Against Women Act on a 68-31 vote. Republicans oppose the bill in part because of language denying grant funds to organizations that discriminate against LGBT people and provisions setting aside more visas for immigrant women in abusive situations. The bill still has to clear the House. And finally, women's rights activists are gearing up for a series of demonstrations across the country tomorrow. The War on Women events, organized by UniteWomen.org, are a response to a recent spate of discriminatory legislation passed by elected officials locally and nationally. FSRN's Brad Kuttner spoke to one of the state-level organizers in Richmond, Virginia.
The War on Women events started as a conversation between two friends in different parts of the country with a simple idea. If we build it, they'll come. Within days of creating a Facebook and Twitter account for the event, they had tens of thousands of followers, and now Unite Women hopes to see that online support manifested locally. In Virginia, where ultrasound legislation limiting abortion passed in the 2012 General Assembly, women's rights protests have hit a boiling point. Brenda Seward, the Virginia state sponsor for Unite Women, got involved after hearing about the day of protests on TV. Organizing this event is her first venture into activism.
Enough is enough, really. We've reached a point where we can't keep letting this go on, this major push for this. It's rolling back legislation that happened 30 or 40 years ago, and it's not just one thing. It seems to be the beginning of a tide of things going in that direction.
Specifics on the War on Women events vary. Virginia's will include speakers and musical performances, but events are happening in every state. Brad Kuttner, FSRN, Richmond.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
Former Liberian President Charles Taylor has been found guilty on 11 counts of aiding and abetting war crimes and crimes against humanity during the civil war in Sierra Leone. The decision came at an international criminal court in The Hague. Taylor is the first former head of state to be convicted by an international court since the Nuremberg trials and was the first sitting head of state ever to be indicted by an international court. Although human rights groups are calling the decision historic, some are questioning the court's verdict and the court's credibility. FSRN's Hermione G. reports.
3 years and 10 months after the prosecution opened its case, the Special Court for Sierra Leone convicted former Liberian President Charles Taylor of war crimes and crimes against humanity. The court found him guilty of aiding and abetting rebel forces who murdered, raped, and used child soldiers during the bloody decade-long civil war in Sierra Leone. Taylor supplied arms and logistical support to the Sierra Leonean rebels, the court found, in exchange for illegally mined diamonds. Taylor was also found guilty of helping to plan two attacks within Sierra Leone in the late 1990s, nicknamed Operation Spare No Soul and Operation No Living Thing. Chief Prosecutor Brenda Hollis told reporters after the verdict was announced that she applauded the judge's decision as a victory for the people of Sierra Leone.
This conviction is one more victory in the very important fight against impunity. Today is for the people of Sierra Leone, who suffered horribly at the hands of Charles Taylor and his proxy forces. This judgment brings some measure of justice to the many thousands of victims who paid a terrible price for Mr. Taylor's crimes.
While Taylor was convicted on 11 counts, the three international judges said that the prosecution failed to prove that he was in command control of the rebel forces, the Revolutionary United Front, and the Armed Forces Revolutionary Council, or that he was part of a joint criminal enterprise with their leader, Fode Senko. Taylor has always maintained that although he had cooperated with the RUF during the Liberian Civil War, his only role in the conflict in Sierra Leone was one of peacemaker. Taylor's defense lawyer, Courtney Griffiths, said that the prosecution was selective and vindictive in bringing the case against Taylor.
Have we forgotten Nicaragua? Have we forgotten El Salvador? So why is it then not a word of complaint is made when it is done by a powerful country, but where a Charles Taylor, for his own national interests, decides to intervene next door, it's criminal. Now, if such behavior is to be deemed illegal, then I'd like to see it being deemed illegal across the board. That whether you're the President of the United States or the Prime Minister of Britain, if you engage in such covert activities and crimes are committed, yes, haul in before an international court. But let's be frank, ladies and gentlemen, do you honestly see that ever happening?
As presiding judge Richard Lusick finished reading the chamber's judgment, alternate judge El Hadji Malik Sow from Senegal announced that he wanted to address the court. But his microphone was turned off and the curtain to the public gallery came down. Griffiths later told reporters that Sow had wanted to express his dissenting view of the ruling. I disagree with the findings and the conclusions of the other judges, Sow told the closed court, according to a typed transcript of his statement, handed out to reporters by the defense team. He said that he did not believe Taylor had been found guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. Sarah Boom Capri Kamara from Sierra Leone was in the courtroom as the ruling came down. She says she's disappointed by the verdict.
According to all the what we have been expecting, was like it's such hard crimes, crimes against humanity, war crimes, international humanitarian law crimes. But the way it is now, it's like, what? He just aided and abetted. And I think they're playing on words. Like, we know what it is in judicial systems. If you're just aiding and abetting, you're not going to get the punishment that someone who directly commits the crime gets.
Victims also want to see some improvement in their lives, she says.
The victims, they've been the ones who have suffered and who have continued to suffer. One thing they would want to see is their reparations. They want to see, their life change for the better. And unfortunately not. It's not happening right now. They're still finding a way. They still barely can have something to eat. And all of these things should be addressed.
Taylor will be sentenced on May 30th and will serve his time in the United Kingdom. Hermione G., FSRN, The Hague.
On Capitol Hill today, the House of Representatives took up the Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act, or CISPA. The bill's broad language allows private companies to share consumers' personal data with the government and one another. While the bill's Democrat and Republican supporters say it's a crucial step to protect the country's databases from foreign and domestic cyber attacks, its path to becoming law has challenges. The White House has threatened a veto, and civil liberties advocates are mobilizing to defeat it. FSRN's Alice Olstein reports.
Privacy and civil liberties advocates say the cybersecurity bill would break down the walls between companies with questionable privacy records, including Google and Facebook, and agencies with a history of privacy violations, including the National Security Administration. But CISPA supporters on both sides of the aisle have countered these concerns, saying the information sharing is voluntary, not required. But lawyer Michelle Richardson with the American Civil Liberties Union says that doesn't address the problem.
The government isn't forcing these companies to turn over the information, and the companies have a choice. But the important thing is that the customers don't. The customers are not going to be able to opt out of this program and prevent their information being shared with the NSA and other military agencies.
Unlike the successful protests against the anti-piracy bills SOPA and PIPA earlier this year, the campaign against CISPA does not have the backing of industry. In fact, most major tech and telecom companies, including Facebook, IBM, AT&T, Microsoft, and Verizon, are actively backing the bill and lobbying for its passage. Josh Levy with the online advocacy group Free Press explained why.
It lets them off the hook for something that they're already doing and participating in. So the National Security Agency is already asking Facebook and other companies for information on its users. It's not actually legal. It lives in a legal gray area. So what this would do is it would indemnify companies like Facebook from any legal challenges for giving up our private information. It would make that behavior officially legal.
CISPA places no limits on the kind of data that can be shared and would override existing anti-wiretapping laws, companies' individual privacy rules, and the Electronic Privacy Act. Any kind of personal data, from bank, education, and medical records to the content of emails, would be up for grabs. The bill would also block any Freedom of Information Act requests from consumers trying to find out who is sharing their personal data with whom. In a speech on the House floor on Thursday, Colorado Democrat Jared Polis raised further concerns about the bill.
CISPA allows information sharing, quote, for the protection of national security, end quote. A broad and undefined category that can include practically everything under the sun. Is a Tea Party activist a threat to national security? Is a communist activist a threat to national security? The danger that this can be used for political oppression and to stifle political speech is very real.
On Wednesday, the president wrote to Congress saying he strongly opposes CISPA, citing a lack of oversight and accountability measures and threatening to veto the bill. Seeking to address these and other concerns, the House took up a long list of amendments to CISPA on Thursday. One provision up for debate strips the immunity CISPA gives companies for improperly sharing personal data. Another limits what kind of data can be shared, and another prohibits the government from saving or using the data for anything other than cybersecurity reasons. Without these safeguards, Josh Levy with Free Press says CISPA will have a chilling effect on free expression on the internet.
It would make it harder for us to communicate online without fear of being spied on, and that would result in us communicating less. This incredible freedom and this incredible opportunity that we had to connect with each other would be chilled because we wouldn't know who's watching, we wouldn't know what the effect of that spying would have on us.
Despite the opposition to CISPA, the bill has strong support from many Democrats and Republicans and is likely to pass the House. To drum up support during Thursday's debate, Texas Republican Mac Thornberry described the consequences of not passing CISPA and leaving the country vulnerable to a cyber attack.
The electricity grid going down, a whole city being poisoned by its water supply, chemical plants releasing emissions that it doesn't intend to release, death potentially and destruction can occur all because of things going on the internet.
But some civil liberties advocates, including the ACLU's Richardson, say these kinds of what-ifs should not scare Congress into signing away important protections.
And those sorts of issues have not materialized yet. It's unclear if they ever will, but they certainly do not merit a response where the NSA is turned loose on the domestic civilian internet.
The House will vote on CISPA and its amendments on Friday. But with the threat of a White House veto and the Senate companion bill still stuck in committee, CISPA has a difficult road ahead to become a law. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
The African Union is calling on Sudan and South Sudan to stop hostilities as the two countries inch closer to the brink of war. AU leaders have proposed a peace deal in an effort to end weeks of fighting and deaths, including aerial bombardments by Sudan. The violence has destroyed villages and halted hopes for many refugees who want to return home. FSRN's Noelle King reports from Cairo, Egypt, where she spoke to Sudanese refugees who have been displaced since the last civil war started decades ago.
At Cairo's All Saints Cathedral, South Sudanese gather for a Dinka language church service. It's a two-hour-long mix of song, sermon, and recitation. Most filter out before the service ends, into the courtyard outside where there is another kind of congregation. Dozens of South Sudanese gather to catch up on the latest news and gossip. One topic commands everyone's attention, the outbreak of hostilities between South Sudan and its neighbor to the north. Sudan is conducting aerial bombing raids in South Sudan following an attempt by the South to seize a Sudanese oil field.
So I'm really worried because we have a family there in South.
Kot Macker is a 22-year-old law student at Cairo's Ain Shams University, who is from the town of Yerol in central South Sudan. He says he has terrible memories of Sudan's brutal civil war, which lasted more than 20 years and cost an estimated 2 million lives.
But now they're not going to, they want to enforce war against us, and we have not feel we don't want war again because we are suffering a lot. We fed up. We don't need it again.
What really bothers Macker is the language that Sudan's President Omar al-Bashir used in a speech last week when referring to the South Sudanese government. He called them insects.
Bashir is this day is calling out that we are insects, we are not people. We need to think about it, and we need international community to condemn this criminal guy.
Last year, South Sudanese voted overwhelmingly in a referendum to split apart from Sudan and form their own nation. But South Sudan's independence didn't end enmity between the two nations. At the heart of the conflict are Sudanese oil reserves. Both Sudan and South Sudan lay claim to rich oil fields that lie along a disputed border. When South Sudan seceded, it took with it about 75% of Sudan's reserves, which lie in southern territory. Earlier this month, South Sudan seized the Higlig oil region from Sudan. South Sudan said it withdrew from the area on Friday. Sudan says that's because it drove southern soldiers out after fierce fighting. Boyenyo Ezekiel is an accountant at the South Sudan Embassy in Cairo. She's one of the hundreds of thousands of South Sudanese who sought refuge in Egypt during Sudan's long civil war. In the year since South Sudan gained independence, thousands of her compatriots have returned home, including many of her friends.
Every month you see that these people is saying a farewell or doing a farewell party for her to go or him to go back.
Boyenyo's husband, Emmanuel, is the reverend at All Saints Cathedral. She and her three young children are committed to remain with him in Cairo until every member of his congregation has returned home to South Sudan. But the ongoing hostilities could delay their return. Another refugee, James Madit, has lived in Cairo for 10 years. He had been planning to go home after 25 years away.
Definitely, I was planning to go back to Sudan, maybe in 2 months' time to go back. But after I heard there is a fighting between the North and South Sudan, so it changed my mind and it led me to think double twice so that what I can do next.
Others say their plans to return home are firm, but their reasons for returning have changed. George Moral Shiman left his home in Rumbek at the age of 5. For 35 years, he has lived as a refugee in Ethiopia, Kenya, and now Egypt. He works for a nonprofit organization in Cairo that provides services to refugees. However, he says if the conflict continues, he'll go home not as an aid worker, but as a soldier.
For depending the nation, it is a cause for all citizens of South Sudan to depend. And even right away now, while I'm not there, all Southerners, all youth who are on my age, they are now on the front line going to depend their territories.
Last July, many Sudanese celebrated the newest country's independence. But less than a year later, the rising tensions have raised questions about the future. Reflecting on the recent fighting, Boyenyo Ezekiel says she expected better than this of the newly independent South.
I was thinking that if we start well, we'll be the really the best country in the world. We would see the experience, the past experience of the nations that have started or that has had their independence maybe 60 years or 40 years back. And I was sure that we wouldn't fall in the same mistakes that they fall into.
Instead, she says she now fears that fighting may spoil the promise and potential of Africa's newest nation and embroil the two Sudans in yet another endless war. Noel King, FSRN, Cairo.
And thank you to Free Speech Radio News for those international headlines.
Daily headlines and their full newscast can be found at their website, fsrn.org. And now, in our last few minutes, we just want to have a nice little chat about, I guess, Occupy Wall Street and Adbusters. Adbusters, as many of you know, is the Vancouver-based magazine that can really be traced as the beginnings of Occupy Wall Street. They're the first people who called for people to go out and occupy Wall Street. And now, actually, they've come out with it again for May 1st. And they've released on their website a so-called tactical briefing, which we're just going to read to you here. This can be found on their website at adbusters.org.
So this is the following, as you hear, is the tactical briefing by Adbusters. Hey you dreamers, strikers, and new left redeemers out there. For 31 magical days, beginning this Tuesday, May 1st, we take the plunge and strike. We block the Golden Gate Bridge, occupy a Manhattan-bound tunnel, seize the ports. In 115 cities, we march into banks, erect tents, and refuse to leave. We disrupt financial institutions, forcing thousands to preemptively close. 5,000 of us pray, dance, sleep on Wall Street and in front of the Fed, and if the Bloombergs of the world bring out paramilitary police to intimidate us, we use our social media fire to call out 50,000 more occupiers and intimidate them right back.
In the week before the G8 and NATO summits, we light the spark globally. We occupy hundreds of squares and cities on every continent, from Paris to Berlin, Toronto to Athens, Sao Paulo to Bucharest and beyond. We up the ante with direct actions that paralyze capitalism. For a few days, maybe for a full month, we act as if we already live in a world run by people, not corporations.
Our movement goes geopolitical later in May. We swarm Chicago and confront NATO. We tell the military elites there to stop their saber rattling against Iran, halt the global arms race, and get behind what the majority of the people on Earth want, a nuclear-free world, starting with a nuclear-free Middle East that includes both Iran and Israel.
And then, when the G8 leaders meet in Camp David, we create a global spectacle the likes of which the world has never seen before. Millions of us, individually, in flash groups and en masse, we burst out laughing at the lunacy of the 8 most powerful political leaders on the planet, thinking they can dictate the people's business from behind closed doors and barbed wire fences. For one day, we take over the global mindspace with a whirlwind of hashtag laugh riot jokes, like, why the G8 chickens cross to Camp David? Because they're on the other side. Ha ha! We laugh our heads off on every news broadcast in the world.
May 1968 was the first Wildcat general strike in history. It lasted 2 weeks and was a grand gesture of refusal, still remembered. But then it fizzled. Maybe this may we want?
Signed, For the Wild, Culture Jammers Headquarters.
And what you just heard was the, quote, tactical briefing written by Adbusters magazine on their blog at adbusters.org. So here on News 101, we thought we'd have a brief discussion on what this means and where it could head.
And I think it's interesting because you hear a lot of discussion on, especially like last fall once Occupy was sort of winding down and it wasn't like such a, people said it might be the end of it or might we see this coming back again in full force in the spring. And I think a lot of people thought that it might actually fizzle out just because, like, of course, the main argument being that they don't have a clear political agenda. They don't have a leader. Like, who is really going to bring all these people out again? Because before it was very much a grassroots movement that just kind of ballooned, whereas to kind of bring that back in full force, it is much more of a direct statement. So it's interesting to see Adbusters, who did kind of start it on some level, or like light the spark, seeming to take ownership of that and really push itself forward and push for that May 1st uprising. I don't know if that's something that had been promoted elsewhere before, because obviously this comes from like 1968 as well, but It'll be interesting to see what the response to that is.
Yeah, and it's also interesting to see how they've now started to focus on the leaders themselves. Like previously, mm-hmm. previous occupiers weren't really focused on leaders.
Mm-hmm.
It was focused on the inefficiencies of the system, the corruption. But this one is directed at G8 leaders and NATO leaders. So I guess this occupies the spring, I guess. I've read past issues of the Adbusters, and they've been talking about the American spring and
mm-hmm.
using this April and May to refer to that. And I don't know how it'll go.
Yeah, I think... I mean, obviously, a lot of the issues that people were coming out for Occupy about, like, those haven't been resolved. And I think what you said about addressing the leaders, it definitely is pertinent and relevant because, I mean, that's where that change gets affected, at least for now, at the end of the day. I mean, obviously, that's not what the movement as a whole would like to see in the future with so much power in those hands, but that's where it is right now. So I think it's interesting, but I think they also have to walk a fine line between, I guess, being the 99% and speaking for the people and veering too far into sort of the activist line of thing, because I think it's been so successful because everyone feels that they can relate to it, like the 99%. Whereas I think a lot of people, when they think of NATO and G8, the protests for that, they think of like black clad activists and very like violent protests for specific issues. And I wonder if a lot of people in the general population will feel actually alienated by that as opposed to connected. But I don't know. We'll have to see.
Yeah. I guess what I'd like, to, if anybody from Adbus is listening right now, hopefully, I'd like to say that it's. I think it's personally, it's very important to get priorities straight. I mean, there are a lot of issues, there are countless issues that we can talk about and that occupiers in the past have been talking about. But it's very important, especially when you're confronting leaders of the G8 and NATO, to get your priorities straight. I mean, you can't start off the conversation with aliens or something like that. You have to start off with things like unemployment, demilitarization, you know, important topics that they can relate to. And, of course, topics that they can agree with on some level and topics that are reasonable enough to bring to the table and discuss.
Yeah.
So hopefully that is what people will take from this new spring.
Yeah, and to our listeners, if any of you have any thoughts on what we're going to be seeing on May 1st or anything you'd like to add to our discussion, feel free to tweet us at CITR News, I believe is our Twitter.
Yes, or email us at news@citr.ca.
And I guess with no further ado, that is our show for today, which is April 27th, a Friday. Happy Friday. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. So if you would like to get involved or give us comments or send us a hot news tip, please feel free to give us a call or email us at news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows and interviews on our website at citr.ca/news. For more independent news, join us on Monday and Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Claire Eagle.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan. Today's show was produced by Claire Eagle. From the entire news team here at CITR, thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Stranded right here on CITR 101.9 FM.
I'm stranded.